should ask, why this rough stuff now, fellas? At the donut shops, drinking hot coffee and soda pops, watching for motorists running stops so we can go practice karate chops. Coffee and donuts, sugar and caffeine, if we don't get it, we get mean. So all you junkies better come clean, it's the LAPD theme. Up against the car, did you hear what I said? Hands in the air or I'll smash your head. You better get on the ground or you'll wind up dead. You're gonna be sorry you ever spent coffee and donuts, sugar and caffeine. If we don't get it, we get mean. So all you junkies better come clean. It's the LAPD theme. You can bet your bottom dollar on the donuts I've eaten that your black butt is gonna get a beating. So go ahead, sue, if you think we're mistreating, and we'll take it up at the next Klan meeting. Coffee and donuts, sugar and caffeine. If we don't get it, we get mean. So all you junkies better come clean. It's the LAPD theme. Against the car, did you hear what I said? Hands in the air or I'll smash your head. You better get on the ground or you'll wind up dead. You're gonna be sorry you ever sped. Coffee and donuts, sugar and caffeine. If we don't get it, we get mean. So all you junkies better come clean. It's the LAPD theme. Your step, you criminal slime, cause we're on the prowl, getting tough on crime. Get your cameras ready, get your lights online, cause we're all pumped up for prime time. Coffee and donuts, sugar and caffeine. If we don't get it, we get mean. So all you junkies better come clean. It's the LAPD theme. Coffee and donuts, sugar and caffeine. If we don't get it, we get mean. So all you junkies better come clean. It's the LAPD theme. It's the LAPD theme. It's the LAPD theme.
And that's Mark Levy, our local songster, up in not Ben Lomond, not Boulder Creek, way beyond there. Starts with a B, though, I think it is. Anyway, he lives in the area, and he's got this, well, he's had this tape out for 5 years, Born to be Wired, including a Santa Cruz song about no sitting in Santa Cruz, which I played last time, about the sitting ban, which is still on the books, still being enforced against the people the police don't want downtown, still an anti-homeless law, still the target of the now purple-shirted hosts. I don't know whether giving them purple hearts for service in the face of all the scorn and hostility they face from folks who realize that the hosts are simply a business sort of front for the to police people away that they don't want down there, rather than to actually be a real hospitality force, which is what Catherine Byers promised us in 1995 when she started this group with Resolution and has backed it up ever since. There is, again, I want to remind you folks, a meeting of ROAR, Restore Our American Rights, campers group, sleepers group, out at the, actually they're a campers group, they camp, because these are people mostly, well, they camp and they sleep. They sleep in their vehicles. I guess some people call it car camping. I'm going to talk about camping and versus sleeping in a moment. Their meeting is at 4:30 today at Du Bois and Harvey West Boulevard. For a phone contact, call Huff. Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We're taking messages for him right now. 423-HUFF, 423-4833. If you want to support them in their search for basic sanitary facilities, for some kind of a responsible camper organization to which people with real and legitimate complaints can turn, a group that tries to exert peer pressure and set up a series of rules for responsible vehicular sleeping as well as responsible camping and responsible plain old sleeping. Give a call to 423-HUFF or come to this meeting at 4:30 today. Again, Harvey West Boulevard and Du Bois, or Du Bois Street, depending on how you pronounce it. It's right out there at Harvey West Park. This is a group that sent a representative to the city council, had her sitting there waiting to talk to Mayor Sugar or Hernandez or Fitzmaurice or any of these people who pose as friends of the homeless. But for some reason, they just couldn't give them the time of day, and they haven't returned my letters either in terms of the specific issue about porta-potties and dumpsters, which seems to me to be something that's a major public health concern. You're not going to get rid of people no matter how many times you send the police through, unless you want to start cutting off people's fingers. I guess they do that in some countries. You cut off your hand in Saudi Arabia if you're convicted of theft, or in certain of those emirates. And I suppose that's one way this country could go. Seems like not the way we would want it to go. And accordingly, I think we got to find some other solution which understands that there's just no housing for most poor people these days, or for many poor people these days, and people are driven into homeless situations. So check out Roar, 430 Harvey West and Du Bois, up there in the corner of the Harvey West Park. And if you want more information, call 423-HUFF, or if you want to say something about this show off-air, give us a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Our on-air number is, of course, 3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Easy to remember, 427-3772. Voicemail is 427-4523. Send your loops, announcements, news, money, notices of demonstrations, whatever you'd like, to P.O. Box 7507. This is for Free Radio Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. You want to listen online to Free Radio? www.microradio.net/FRSC. And email is frsc@microradio.net or at cruzio.com. And if you missed any of those, call the voicemail, 427-4523, and you can hear them at your own speed. And if you have a message for me off the air, again, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Now, last week was an interesting week for me, and a busy one, partially because the district attorney sent in one of its prime shooters, George Kovacevich, who was actually a judge for a couple of months in 1996, and is now a top guy in the district attorney's office, one of their big guns, to prosecute the public menace of Jerry Henry. You may remember I've talked about Henry before. He's a activist and street minister from the Rancho Del Mar shopping center area, lived in Aptos all his life, and began to notice harassment both of himself and young people at the Rancho Del Mar shopping center. He began to resist it, to protest it peacefully, and as a consequence, he started getting a slew of restraining orders, arrests, harassment. And finally, he was arrested in the fall on a $100,000 bail for, quote, interfering with a business, trespass, and public nuisance. None of those are violent crimes. None of those are crimes against property in terms of destroying anything, or against a person in terms of hurting a person physically. It is all essentially an attempt to get him to leave the shopping center. In fact, the merchants and the police who've been pushing this, the deputies out there, have said they'll all drop the charges if only he'll just go away and disappear into the woodwork like a good undesirable transient element, like a good homeless person, like a good troll. Get out of town, do like we tell you to, boy, is what they're telling him. But his response is, this nigga's tired of sitting on the back of the bus. And because of that, he was taken to court for allegedly using the word nigger in reference to himself. Now, they brought that case to the edge of trial, they dropped it, and then they arrested him on $100,000 bail for this whole bunch of other charges. They arrested him a second time on $100,000 bail, for essentially the same thing, actually for violating the OR order that said he had to stay away from the shopping center. He actually did stay away, but he called to someone who he knew inside the shopping center who knew him. They had a friendly talk, and that was considered to be the basis for another $100,000 five-day stay in jail. So clearly punitive that it really impeaches the integrity of every single judicial officer and cop that was involved in that whole process. And it just shows you how deeply corrupt the system of so-called justice we have is in Santa Cruz, that this would be allowed to continue. And we thought that the authorities would be so embarrassed that they would have dropped this case, but they haven't. They've gone to trial with it. He faces 11, I guess now it's been dropped to 8 counts, up to 10 years in jail. These are misdemeanors for, again, obscure concocted charges that in October he interfered with a business by, they claimed, shouting outside the store. Now note, they didn't arrest him on the day he did that. They arrested him later. because obviously there was no problem at the time. It was simply they were putting together some kind of a case to get rid of him. It was essentially a conspiracy between merchants, probably judicial officials, I suspect, but certainly deputy sheriffs, to get rid of a person whose message was considered unwanted and, in fact, was advising young people of their rights at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. So this case has been going on for the last week. The prosecution has had this number of people who've testified that he was shouting obscenities and so forth. But Henry is an interesting person. He has kept tapes, he said, of almost every time he's been there, audio tapes. And he wants to make to play them to impeach the testimony of these people, saying that he does not swear. He was not shouting. He was approached and harassed instead. He essentially is the basis of a cooked-up conspiracy. There's the word. I mean, in this case, it seems to be the case. That is to say, a conscious agreement to engage in something illegal and underhanded that violates a basic human right here of an individual, conspiracy to eliminate him from that area. And on Monday, we will be hearing the last day of testimony in Department 2. Judge Bill Kelsey is hearing the case, sitting as a commissioner. He's a retired judge, not my favorite judge either. Blustering, browbeating kind of judge who masquerades as your uncle, but he's actually very abusive. He, in terms of, let's say, acknowledging elementary rights, for example, we're able to tape record at this trial, though we haven't sought permission to tape record for public use, or at least I have it only for my own notes. But he doesn't even sign the order allowing you to tape record. He doesn't, which is, I think, required judicially for him to do that. Instead, he likes to think he's doing everybody a favor by whatever he does with them. He's the very model of a bad judge, as many of these people are. They're all out of the district attorney's office, largely, and I think a couple of exceptions, but generally they're old DAs from the Danner Department who now himself has his own judgeship. It's a pretty sickening situation here in Santa Cruz, but then again, that's par for the course. So anyway, the trial resumes. I believe it is at 9 or 10 o'clock tomorrow, and hopefully I'll get a call in from activist and reporter and actually co-producer of the show, Becky Johnson. Well, speak of the devil, who's going to be talking about it. She's been sitting at the trial and taking extensive notes. Let's see what she's got to say. Sorry, wrong. Say that again.
Hi, this is Becky Johnson calling.
Okay, Becky. Yeah, you've been at the trial, I know, although you've been sick a lot last week. What's been happening at that trial?
Well, we saw a parade of prosecution witnesses that were mostly, we saw the owner of Rancho Liquors, Al Pepper. We saw Colleen Crosby, who owns the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company. And then we also saw Claudia Easterby, who's the manager of, or was the manager of Gottschalk.
Now, in fact, there are four stores clustered around this sheriff's substation, which really kind of began all the trouble back in 1997 when they set up this new sheriff's substation there. That's my understanding. Is that
mm-hmm.
yours?
Yeah, I think it was 97, in the fall of 97, that the substation started to operate. And that does seem to, coincidentally, and even one of the prosecution witnesses said that, did sort of coincidentally occur at the time when all of a sudden Jerry Henry became persona non grata around the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center.
Now, previously, Henry had been kind of accosted by First Alarm security people, who I guess control, they're the security forces there.
But right, well, we heard mixed testimony on that. There was one security guard who'd worked there on a different shift, and he said he'd never had any problem with Jerry Henry and thought he was fine. His behavior was fine, and he never had a reason to interfere with what Jerry was doing.
Were there other security guards who testified otherwise?
Yeah, Blair McEwen appears to be have a completely different attitude towards Jerry, and that's where a source of a lot of problems came, because Blair McEwen, according to testimony from the defense side, would just come up and tell them that they'd been there long enough and they needed to move on, and if they didn't move on, that he'd call the authorities and have them arrested or have them evicted from the shopping center, which they determined to be private property.
In fact, of course, shopping centers aren't private, or they're private property technically, but they're open to the public, and since you can't really evict someone from a shopping center without cause, particularly if they're engaged in First Amendment activity.
I think that that's what this whole trial is about. Jerry Henry's both right to be in a space that's open to the public, and then hence has ruled as though it's public property, and his right, his First Amendment rights to talk to people he wants there, and the shouting that basically what they're saying is that he was shouting at the shopping center at certain times, and that the shouting created a stressful environment, and so therefore he must be prohibited from being at the shopping center because of the stress. And
it seems to me that if that were the case, I mean, any time a person is accused of disturbing the peace, that's a particular, you know, a charge, and you can, you know, certainly remove that person, arrest them, try them. But it seems to me what they've done is they've patched together a whole bunch of charges actually from in October of 1999, but then they're talking about a whole pattern of behavior back from 1997 as well. You want to comment on that?
I do see one disturbing of the peace of the what the charges that he was accused for, and it referred to a single incident with a patron of Gottschalk's. A woman who, by the way, they flew down from Humboldt County, the district attorney's office, paid for her airfare back and forth, and a person in the district attorney's office drove out to the airport to fetch her, a woman who only walked into Gottschalk's one time and was disturbed because a man was there shouting, sitting on the on his own vehicle in the parking lot. She said it frightened her. So I don't know why the Gottschalk's, if Jerry Henry was such a problem, why they didn't use one of their more regular patrons to come down. It seemed odd.
Well, there was testimony that Henry and I guess the young people who he was advising about their rights circulated a petition urging that the First Amendment not stop at the gates of the shopping center, right? And that got hundreds of signatures, and presumably some of those signatures were patrons, right?
They were. They were. In fact, Jeff Hickey testified that 75% of the people that they approached to sign the petition did end up signing it.
Now, Jeff Hickey is kind of a young person that talked about how Jerry was kind of a role model for him, or at least it helped him get off of drugs, and that Jerry has sort of been a helper to young people rather than a bad influence. Although I guess, again, to me, all this stuff is kind of secondary. The real question is, if somebody is disturbing the peace, there's a certain level where, you know, I stand downtown and I shout about the sleeping ban at different times, and I'm very careful to not to do it at 11 o'clock at night when people are trying to sleep, not to do it in such a fashion as to be personally abusive to any individual who's walking by, other than possibly to single out council members in terms of identifying them and inviting them to speak and calling them out for their behavior on that, which I think is appropriate. But there's a standard beyond which, you know, you can call it disturbing the peace. You start screaming and ranting and raving and challenging to fight. That could be disturbing the peace. And certainly, Jerry Henry could have been taken to jail for that charge and tried on it instead of being tried on this kind of a combination of trespass to interfere with the business. Are they talking about him wandering around the store and refusing to leave when they make that charge?
Apparently there was only one incident that I could see at all that was alleged to have happened in the store. And
the
that
store, of course, is Gottschalk's.
Gottschalk.
Which is the main kind of leader in this effort, it looks like, to get Henry removed.
Yeah, that involved person who worked at Gottschalk's crouching down behind the counter because they were frightened of him.
And you remember the date of that incident? It certainly wasn't in October of 1999 when Jerry was arrested twice on $100,000 bail. It must have been much earlier because there was a restraining order that kept him out of those areas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. So, yeah, all the charges that are against Jerry Henry come from 3 days in October, the 11th, the 15th, and the 19th. And yet, in even his opening statement, Kovacevic didn't even mention any of the events on those 3 days. Instead, he went on to describe a whole series of complaints that he had about Jerry Henry starting in 1997. And I just don't understand why the prosecution is doing that. In any other trial I've ever seen, they would go after the events of specifically to do with those charges on those particular days. I know what they're doing in the sense that one of the 11 charges is that they basically want to declare Jerry Henry is a public nuisance. And so, therefore, anything, you know, whether he was bad in school when he was 7 could be theoretically brought in to prove that he's a nuisance. It's just all over the map.
Well, what about the jury? Is the jury buying all this? What do you think? You've got an eye on the jury.
Well, the jury, I think, is not happy about being a jury. They're not happy about being there. They'd rather be somewhere else. They've tired of the trial even by the before the prosecution had finished presenting their side, which is always a problem with jury trials. By the time the defense gets around to starting to talk, they want to go home. They want to get it over with. And the quickest thing to do is really get some sort of conviction of some sort to justify their having been there.
And there's so many charges.
I do think that there was one witness that was really influenced the jury, and that was a woman in a wheelchair who spoke in very glowing terms about her association with Jerry Henry. And because she knows other people at the shopping center, her daughter works in one of the stores, being disabled as she is, she testified that she's often at the shopping center sitting in her car in the parking lot for hours at a time observing what's going on, and that she would even be observing Jerry when he didn't even know she was there. Kovacevic asked her on the cross if he had said something like, I wish those niggers would just go back to the back of the bus and call an American Indian woman, a half-breed.
These are claims by
by the prosecution.
Right, and now, in fact, of course, he was referring to himself. He says as a nigger.
Well, now we did hear an ancient employee of Rancho Liquors. I think it was John Bonet, who came in. No, I'm sorry, I've got the name wrong. I've mixed that up with a different witness, who said that. Well, what did Jerry Henry say when he was shouting? And he said, oh, he said something about wanting the niggers to still be in the back of the bus. He was, of course, the only person that testified that. Everybody else said, including most of the prosecution witnesses, said that Jerry was referring to himself as though he was being treated like the nigger being told to go to the back of the bus.
And this, of course, is because there was a restraining order that was drawn up that prevented him from going into the coffee roasting company to get coffee or to hang out in an area outside there. So he had to stay outside a chalk-lined area.
He literally had a line on the ground where he personally was not allowed to cross, and this caused him great distress, and he vocalized his distress at that. And that's why they're saying he's a nuisance, because in the process of vocalizing his distress over how badly they were treating him, they said that, yeah, he was disturbing the shoppers, therefore should be banned completely. And here's our district attorney's office, Ron Ruiz, I hope you're listening, spending all this time and money getting together with merchants who don't like this guy in front of their stores. They prefer to think of the area as their private property with all of the controls that private property has, when in fact it is treated like the area is legally considered to be public space, being open to the public, and therefore any member of the public has every right to be there, to express freedom of speech, to shop or to not shop.
You know, Becky, it makes one wonder if one shouldn't consider a strategy, if activists wanted to support him, of actually looking for exactly the opposite from Ron Ruiz, namely prosecutions against store owners who are violating the UNRRA Civil Rights Act, which guarantees equal access to public accommodations to people, and no discrimination without a just cause. And perhaps what we should do is all of us go into one of these stores and, you know, look around as though we're shoppers and have a person videotaping. And also we should have little free Jerry Henry buttons on and so forth. And then when they start fucking with the people, as they may well do, I know Borders did this with the bare-breasted brigade, in spite of their claims that they were going to be sympathetic.
And Jeff was not allowed to buy Cheez-Its for Jerry Henry at Rancho
Right,
Liquor.
Jerry Henry Jeff Hickey, Jerry Henry's youthful friend, was told to leave the liquor store nearby when he came in to buy some snacks for Jerry, because he was a friend of Jerry's, and that was considered to be impermissible. But to actually have that on videotape might be helpful and impress the prosecutor to start prosecuting violations of the civil rights of the people who are the customers, as well as those who have the money and who own the stores, and who are the new kind of grand seigneurs, the new landlords, you know, the new dukes and duchesses of town. This trial resumes on Monday. When does that happen?
Well, I think it starts at 10 in the morning, and it's Jerry Henry. When we left on Friday, Jerry Henry had taken the witness stand and was being interviewed by defense attorney Kristen Carter of the Public Defender's Office. So what we'll see on Monday will be Kovacevic's cross-examination of Jerry Henry, and then the final defense witness is Richard Quigley.
What about all those tapes?
The tapes, we're still wondering when and where all those tapes are going to come in. Perhaps they'll come in...
These are the audio tapes that Jerry made, which would show that the prosecution witnesses are lying, right?
Well, we're hoping to hear that some of these conversations that were discussed by both the prosecution and the defense witness, that we can hear those actual conversations and see what people actually said. I'm sure that would help the jury a lot in determining who is accurate.
You say the final witness is Richard Quigley?
Final witness is Richard Quigley, which if any of you have heard Richard Quigley on Dr. Shapiro's Broadsides or seen it on my television show, Club Cruise, you know that Richard Quigley is a very colorful person with very outspoken thoughts and interesting ideas, and Department 2, Judge Kelsey's court, on Monday, and check it out for yourself.
Now, the public defender has gotten a certain amount of flack from me. I understand she spent all of half an hour's worth of time on the case until a week or two ago. What's your sense of this public defender's performance?
That is a problem with the public defender's office, that they don't spend enough time on cases. And some of these are serious cases, and even in this case, Jerry Henry, if you add up all the charges and what the maximum fine for that, he could face up to 15 years in prison for this, speaking his mind and objecting and counseling youth. So that is a problem. But I do think that I like her forthrightness. She speaks up. She is clear and understandable. She seems passionate about the case, and I think that given there were cases where witnesses, I thought issues should have been gone into more thoroughly, and had she had more preparation, she would have gone into those in a more chronological manner, organized, less haphazard.
Well, I also noticed that the $100,000 bail has not been mentioned by anybody,
well,
which is kind of strange.
That is not an accident. They feel that if they bring up the $100,000 bail, and that happened twice, that Jerry Henry was taken to jail, placed on $100,000 bail, held for, I think, four days the first time, and released on his own recognizance after that, and then they did it again a second time. This with no allegations of violence in any of the charges, no allegations of property damage. Jerry Henry's never been convicted of a crime previously, so it's really a bizarre use of our bail system.
They probably maybe had some kind of private deal in chambers about this, but I would think this would
The defense attorney's concerned about it because they're afraid that if the jurors hear that, they'll say, well, you mean like two other judges all thought that this was serious enough to warrant $100,000 bail, and they thought that that might be prejudicious to the jury. So they're reluctant to raise it themselves.
It could have the opposite effect, though, since the point of Jerry's case is to show a campaign of harassment by merchant security guards and deputy sheriffs out there.
And the
courts, excellent.
That's tricky, bringing that up in a court.
Well, you're hopefully before a jury, which can strike down the instructions of a court, which can it can ignore the law if it thinks that justice demands that.
Or they can rule quickly and go home to their golf dates and their teas.
That's correct. Maybe they can rule in his favor. Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be nice.
All it takes is one juror to just say no and hang tough, although that's a hard thing to do. And that's what we call jury nullification, or maybe even, you know, jury empowerment. We've been talking to Becky Johnson, who co-produces the show, and who also has her own show, Club Cruise. Anything coming up this week, Becky, we should know?
We're going to replay the tape with James Ney and Chalk Crime on Pacific Avenue, which I think people will find interesting.
Indeed, those charges against Ney have not been dismissed. Is that correct?
Well, I heard that the actual arrest by Officer Brandt, which you will see, which was videotaped and is on that show.
7 o'clock on channel.
We're our brand new channel. We're on 27 now.
Okay, 7 o'clock on 27 for those who have cable.
What
about the brand
arrest?
Tuesdays
and Thursdays at 7 p.m.
Uh-huh. Tuesdays and Thursdays.
When James went down to find it, they couldn't find it in their court records. They had lost the record of his arrest.
Oh, my, for heaven's sakes. Well, listen, thank you for calling in, Becky.
Sure.
All right. And there's a woman who takes copious notes as well as good videotapes, and I'm glad she gave us that discussion of what's happening at the Henry trial. But if you want to find out for yourself and support Henry, come on down, Department 2, did she say 9 or 10 o'clock? Maybe you remember out there, folks. I guess come down at 9 to be sure, but 10 if you're a late sleeper. Henry's case has also gotten virtually no play at all in the media. You will find a story about it in the Mid-County Post of several weeks ago, and I've turned out a kind of a flyer on that. But the story also does not mention the $100,000 bail, and that's because of censorship by Mid-County Post editor Mary Bryant. Incoming call. Hi there.
It is 9:30 Monday morning.
Hey, thank you. Well, splitting the difference. 9:30, Department 2 tomorrow. Be there to support Jerry Henry and to observe your Justice Department at work. Your DA's office at work, your court system at work, and also, hopefully, wouldn't it be nice, the jury system at work. That would be so, so refreshing to see either a not guilty or a hung jury, because I think the hung jury would send this case to the trash can where it belongs. Also happening yesterday that people should know about was a case against our old friend Robert Steffen, the umbrella man. The man who sits on Pacific Avenue, or was sitting on Pacific Avenue, in front of Bunny Shoes on that bench out there, with a plastic trash bag wrapped around him frequently, and he's running for president. He's had his campaign on a kind of a little shopping cart in front of him, or luggage carrier. And he's been there on and off since October, after having been three times arrested for trespass at the River Street at the Homeless Services Center. And that's in a situation where there was no legal places for him to sleep. He slept on the porch, and they demanded that he leave and go onto public property. He said, no, there's a sleeping ban. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to sleep right here unless you want to put me in your program. They wouldn't put him in the program. And instead, Ken Cole had him arrested. And there's more to it than that. Ken will tell you that he tried to make certain accommodations which were not acceptable to Steffen, and that Steffen, you know, would not do, quote, work that they insisted he do. But my understanding of the case is that it was another case of a bureaucracy tossing a homeless person to the wolves, and although they didn't insist to be prosecuted, he eventually was. He was put on probation for a year, found guilty of trespassing at the Homeless Services Center. Get that, a homeless person found guilty of trespassing at the Homeless Services Center. Not because he was a violent guy, not because he was selling drugs, but because he was trying to sleep. And That probation came up yesterday because the authorities some months ago tried to get this man... there was a temporary restraining order taken out against him because they claimed that his being there frightened the employees. The sight of him out there was just too much for those Barbie folks to deal with. And I say that not with any personal animosity to individuals inside. I've actually interviewed some of them for the show. It's a kind of the lifestyle. It's folks are generally pretty heavily made up. They are selling expensive shoes and hats to people who are looking for largely luxury items, and that's what they are. And then they don't like the sight of poverty outside their store. It doesn't go too well with their menu. Well, that's how it goes, folks. Also, there were complaints from Palomar Hotel residents who wanted to use the bench themselves, although there are plenty of benches out there. Or let me put it this way. There were other benches and could have been more put out there if the residents had wanted to make had pressed for that. And I played a tape last week that talked about that, somewhere residents were saying, we don't want any more benches. That would just have more undesirables show up. Well, you know, we all live in this area. We all have to use the public spaces and share them. It's true that Robert Steffen would sit on the bench and sat there all day, but there also usually are plenty of open benches. So the idea that his is the only bench, I find not persuasive. And neither did the judge back in December, who finally looked at this TRO after he'd been forced away from that area for about a month and a half and said, no, you can't. There's no basis for it. So he went back to that bench. Then around came the police, and they had him 5150 taken off to the nut ward, claiming he needed to be, shot up with drugs, or he was loony, couldn't take care of himself. And the nut ward said, uh-uh, released him the next day. Sorry. Hi, you're on the phone with Free Radio.
Robert North, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good, Bob. Are you listening to the show, perhaps?
An excellent show. You've had an excellent show from the start. The interview with the guy in Eugene was excellent. It shows that you can actually do things. The stone can be moved.
Right. Before you get into that, let me quickly finish up this business with Robert Steffen, because we can. I'll do that as I talk to you. So, and then we can discuss what you want to speak about. Robert Steffen was hauled away. He was hauled away in this alleged bogus "Are you crazy?" check, and he was released the next day because he wasn't crazy. He's eccentric, and he is, you might say, bizarre in his behavior. But that's how he is, and the Constitution protects those sorts of things. So, about 2 months ago, during the Art, Wine, and Cheese Festival, or maybe a month and a half ago, he was again hauled away to the same nut ward, and the same thing happened, although he stayed there a couple more days, but they wanted him out of the area just for the festival. He didn't look nice on the bench for all those middle-class people. It reminded them there was poverty in town, something they did similarly with other people who were homeless during the Art, Wine, and I guess Jazz Festival, or the Cheese, Wine, and Art. I can never get it quite right. Finally, yesterday in court, I should say day before yesterday on Friday, Robert Steffen was taken to court for disturbing the peace. Whose peace was it disturbing, and what was the nature of the charge? Well, he was charged with shouting, "Stop! Bring back my sign! Stop!" because someone grabbed his presidential sign, tore it in half, and ran down the street with it. The police refused to take a report. Instead, they took a complaint from the woman who ran the hat shop, who ended up filing the complaint. And this court hearing was not a jury trial for Mr. Steffen. It was a probation violation. Remember, he had a probation for sleeping on the porch of the Homeless Services Center. Well, now he faced, without an attorney on his side, without a jury, and with a standard of evidence much lower that required only that the prosecution show he was guilty by a preponderance of the evidence rather than beyond a reasonable doubt, before a prejudiced judge, Art Danner, formerly a DA. And, of course, Danner quickly ruled for the prosecution that he had violated his probation. So now he has been barred from a significant segment of Pacific Avenue and told the only lawful business he can engage in that area on Pacific Avenue, he cannot loiter. All he can do is, and I quote you, shop. S-H-O-P is the only legal business Robert Steffen can do, according to Judge Art Danner. So I am incensed about this, and it may sound like I'm blaming this caller, and I'm not. The caller had nothing to do with this. In fact, caller, what have you got to tell me?
Robert?
Yes.
It's stunning, but I'm numb, and I'm in a contempt phase. And contempt is the act of despising and lack of respect. Disdain and aversion for the contemptible, progressive so-called community in Santa Cruz that has consistently looked the other way at the most important issues that should be on the agenda.
All hail the progressive slate.
Absolutely. Robert, it's contemptible. And the name Art Danner, and all you can do is shop. And Jerry Henry is an interesting case in point. The few activists that have showed up there, and my commendations go to Becky and yourself, and especially Richard Quigley, who is extremely articulate, and I'm going to try to be there tomorrow, by the way, to witness Mr. Quigley's presentation. But it's very interesting, the activists that show up for these kinds of things and those that look the other way and will say things like, they're all like that, and who are you going to replace them with, and all this stuff, and then they're all worried about the riparian corridor that might be threatened. Not that environmentalism isn't important, but if we're going to use environmentalism to deny things like exploitation and abuse of power, then we're cowards. And basically, Robert, I have contempt for it, and I'm tired of it.
Well, I understand that, Bob, and you're not alone in being tired of it, and I guess we'll be expecting you to raise these issues big time in the upcoming... Well, you are raising them right now.
It's Dauphin Lee is interesting in that it represents ground zero for low-income housing in Santa Cruz. Basically, at this point, when those tenants are removed, if they are removed, there's nowhere to go. All right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very interesting reality check in that regard, and I think it's interesting that it was one of the few times where I have seen this progressive, mediocre bandwagon stopped in this town.
Mm-hmm.
This mediocre rubber stamp, here we are, we're progressives. This thing about Hernandez and sugar and the racist comments is a deflection from the issue.
Definitely.
It's absolutely disgusting. Everybody knows these things, Robert, including the SCAN steering committee, but they will not stand up for what they believe in, therefore they have no principle, they are not leaders.
Well, I will say for the SCAN steering committee, not so much the steering committee, but the housing committee, that it was they who brought to the SCAN general membership the Dauphin Lee's demand that there be real guarantees, and that was what, of course, set sugar off. And although I must say, the SCAN resolution did not make it to City Council until June 19th, 3 weeks after it was passed, and 6 days after the council meeting where it should have been, you know, well in hand for. So.
Well, I'll give a commendation there, and great, but I think that they saw that their power base was shifting and they wanted to jump on a bandwagon and usurp it. I want to tie two issues together. I realize that the time's running short. Living wage and rent control. One of the things that modern government is supposed to do is mitigate the impact of unbridled capitalism. And we can see this here in Santa Cruz big time. And living wage says that you cannot so grossly exploit people in a community that considers itself to be political and liberal. So it makes a stand and it says, we will subsidize. We'll do our best to make this issue relevant. Rent control says that you don't own property, you pay for somebody else's mortgage, you have the basic decency of having your rent increase regulated. Very modest. And it ought to be on the front burner. It'll serve 27,000 people. It'll serve the majority of citizens in Santa Cruz. And my opinion is that land trusts, although it's nice, it's a fun project, it's cronyistic, and it's a diversion from rent control.
I hear you. Bob, I got to get running. I got 10 minutes left. Anything more you want to say before I...
I would hope that what we see coming out of the Jerry Henry trial is the leadership that calls himself progressive, standing up for something that has principle, and coming public for something for once, before it's a done issue and a bandwagon. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Bob. And of course, that's what I've been saying to Mayor Sugar and Christopher Crone for the last 18 months, is they need to come public on issues like Dauphin Lee and the sleeping ban, not just because it's a matter of integrity, but also in order to educate the public, in order to help press wavering council members, in order to keep honest those who have bad positions, and perhaps to educate them as well. But they don't believe in that approach. It's the back room approach. It's let's all get together beforehand, make our plans, and proceed. And I'm afraid that, you know, that's something that I'm not... It doesn't work, as you can see in this current disaster around sleeping ban repeal. They're now running like scared rabbits, even Christopher Crone, if the Sentinel story on Saturday is correct. Crone now doesn't favor the safe sleeping zones, even though people like Michael Schmidt, who you heard on the radio on Thursday, say there's obviously no reason to change our position because of some wild alarmist cries from a few or even a great number of cries, but it's actually from a small number of businesses on the in the Harvey West area and in the Natural Bridges area, because the problem isn't going away. The problem of lots of folks needing to sleep at night and having no place to do it, and doing it then where they can. And it's obviously better to have it in a situation where there are facilities of some kind than have it happen, yes, on your backyard, because that's where it's going to happen if there aren't legal places to go, and if there isn't a system of in process where people feel it's more sensible for them to respect the law and to respect other people. So it has to be done through an open process. It wasn't. And so what we have now is more closed process, more government by innuendo and sentinel press release. It's really disgusting. And it's going to come up again at City Council on Tuesday. Encourage you to call City Council at 420-5017. Tell them, no way are you going to run on the safe sleeping zones. If you're going to try to abandon that, you better put something in its place that is equally good. Do it through an open process. Don't abandon the Dolphin Lee Residente Unidos tenants. Instead, work with them. Don't surrender to private interest groups, even if they are masquerading. And particularly don't surrender to old redevelopment agency hacks who should have been fired long ago and replaced with new blood, but nobody on the council had the guts to even bring the matter up in any significant way. Well, we're reaching the end of our show. We have about 7 minutes left. We're going to be out of here actually a minute or two in advance in order to surprise the next talk show host, Little Red Hen, who I think has a surprise host here. It's a younger host for once. We've always heard of the programming for the young. This is a person who is genuinely young and also very short, I would have to say. Probably, 3 feet tall? This is a... perhaps a word from our next talk show host. You want to say hello?
Can I say hello?
Walk over here and hear me. Say hello. Say hello into that kind of strange thing there. Say hello.
You
want
to say hello, Elena?
What do you think? You want to say hello?
You can say free radio.
She shakes her head. I hope I'm getting the gender right here. I'm trying to be gender neutral. Next week on Free Radio Santa Cruz, on next Sunday, we'll have a special show with George Cavallo, if we can find him. He has agreed to be on the air. We're going to drag him down with a butterfly net if we have to 5150 him. This guy is the psychiatric ombudsperson, who is the guy who comes and helps you out if you get captured by the police, who tell you they're dragging you away from City Council because you're a danger to yourself, others are gravely disabled, as they did to David Silva, the so-called psychiatric hold. There is a new law on the books, or soon to be on the books, or hopefully it won't be on the books, AB 1800, and it is a very nasty law. I'm going to read you just a few things about it, and we're going to talk more about it in a week with George, who's also opposed to it. Changing the commitment laws is unwarranted because the current criteria are adequate, and expanding involuntary treatment will not provide the quick fix for problems with the current system. The number of involuntary commitments are rising under current law. There is a widespread misconception that the LPS law, which is the current law, makes it virtually impossible to be committed. This, too, has led to a call by some to radically dismantle the existing structure. The facts are that the number of commitments in California under the current law has continued to rise year after year. The available Department of Mental Health stats substantiate this fact. Despite the fact, while current data is available from the counties to illuminate this increase, the Department of Mental Health has failed to compile and analyze this data in a usable form since 1995. So they're pushing for this law, but then they're not giving us the data that shows that they're having more commitments anyway. LPS law already allows for outpatient commitment. Counties erratically implement the existing law. Adequate outpatient services do not currently exist. Hospital dumping rather than non-compliance contributes to the current problems in the system. Mental health clients need community-based choices, not coercion. There is a lack of desirable voluntary community-based services. Mental health services must address the needs of the whole person. The village model, helping the whole person, an effective mental health system incorporates the self-help model. Although most persons with mental disabilities are competent to make decisions, the myth that they are incompetent drives the political agenda to expand forced treatment. And the broken brain theory does not agree with conventional wisdom or the experience of recovery. You'll hear more about that in 2 weeks. Existing law addresses true incompetence. Involuntary outpatient commitment, which means needles on wheels going to your house to shoot you up with drugs if you don't show up, violates basic constitutional rights guaranteed to all Americans. Expanded forced treatment, how it would work. Forced treatment of non-dangerous persons violates the right to liberty. I'm reading you some headings that we're going to be discussing. Forced medication of non-dangerous persons violates the rights to informed consent and privacy. Involuntary outpatient commitment curtails freedom without reducing violence, hospital readmission rates, or the state's budget. Expanding forced treatment is not a solution to treatment noncompliance. There is a natural aversion to forced treatment, which results in treatment noncompliance and undermines therapeutic relationships. Expansion of forced treatment will exacerbate the problem of noncompliance. Forced treatment is antithetical to therapeutic relationships. Medical noncompliance is a problem endemic to all health fields. Treatment noncompliance is a response to unacceptable services. The unfounded stereotype of people with mental disabilities as being violent is driving the political agenda to expand forced treatment and outpatient commitment. People with mental disabilities are no more violent than the general public. The public stereotypes people with mental disabilities as violent. And we're going to have more to talk about when we do get back to this on Sunday. Again, today at 4:30, check out the meeting of ROAR, Restore Our Alienated Rights, at 4:30 at Du Bois and Harvey West Park Boulevard. I'll be out there. Hope to see you there. Probably be a meeting of Residente Unidos tomorrow. Give a call to 466-9520 to get more information on that. City Council, be there if you can. 1 o'clock at the closed litigation session if you want to talk about the property and keeping the property, or certainly at the afternoon and evening sessions. I'm going to go out on a little bit of music here and turn the mic over to the little red hen and one of her little chicks who's here checking out the scene, and hopefully she'll be able to get that chick to do a little talking. And we will be back on Thursday at 6 o'clock for another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I hope you'll join us. It's been good having you with us. 423-HUFF between shows, 423-4833. Give us a call, and do call City Council, 420-5017. Keep the sleeping ban repeal and strengthen it, and protect the rights and guarantees of the Dolphin Lee tenants.
He was one of those dogged old men who live in the past, telling stories you don't want to know about how it was then. The hunger, the hardship, the hopes and the struggles of so long ago. And we must have looked bored, for like sparks from the cinders, his eyes glowed with anger, his words seemed to burn. He said, I will be heard, for my life is not over. I've something to say yet, you've something to learn. He said, you who have nothing at all to believe in, for you whose motto is money comes first, who are you to tell us that our lives have been wasted and all that we fought for has turned into dust? I was only a lad when we read that in Russia the workers, the Soviets, had taken all power, and the man they called Lenin who led them was our inspiration. His triumph was our finest hour, and I'll always remember how fear shook the wealthy like thieves who have just been caught out in their crime. But we who had known only war and the workhouse rejoiced that a new world was born at that time. You can't know what it meant, and the pride that we felt to know working people, people like us, could shake off the shackles, could topple the palaces, remake the world without ruler or boss. It was this kept us going, this dream of a new world, through all those dark years of defeat and despair, when we who were proud to proclaim ourselves communists fought for that world free from hunger and fear. It was down with a means test, no cuts in our wages, we want £3 a week and a 7-hour day. And there wasn't a thing that we got, but we fought for it. Don't you know bosses give nothing away? And the strikes and the marches, the battles to beat off the bailiffs and coppers when hope was still young. Hot heads and hot hearts, as we tested our power, the workers triumphant, and that was our song. For a time he was silent and lost in his memories, then, but more softly, his words came again. Perhaps we hoped for too much, perhaps the cost was too much. There are things I know now that I couldn't know then. We believed revolution was just round the corner, and we were the vanguard to bring it about. And the other left parties we classed as class traitors, bourgeois social fascists, of that we no doubt. And then the times changed, we campaigned for the popular front. The old line might never have been but we led the workers in combating fascism, Mosley in London and Franco in Spain. We believed we were history's chosen, and Soviet Russia, our future, our heart and our soul. And the five-year plan was a vision of plenty for us who'd lived half of our lives on the dole. We knew of the trials and purges, of course, and were shocked when we heard those old comrades confess. But yes, we defended the first worker state in the face of the slander and lies of the press. And you, who have nothing at all to believe in, are you whose motto is money comes first? Who are you to tell us that our lives have been wasted and all that we fought for has turned into dust? You may think we were duped. Well, we paid for our dreams, broken lives, broken marriages, jobs lost in jail. Some lost heart and left, some betrayed us for medals. There are always some turncoats whose souls are for sale. But the best of us never surrendered our vision, and we kept the faith through the bleakest defeat. Do you think that was easy? Surrounded by hatred, the sneer of indifference, the hurt of deceit. And our lives were made rich by the cause that we fought for, the friendship, the fellowship, sharing one aim, to transform society, end exploitation. And that day will come yet, though not in my time. And again he was silent, and what could we tell him? That the world now was different, that he'd had his day, that an old man's dreams were not our concern. But still, there was something he wanted to say. Now, when I look back, I see what we fought against: homelessness, hunger, injustice and war. But what did we fight for? What dream did we strive for? I used to know once, now I'm no longer sure. But you, who have nothing at all to believe in, are you whose motto is money comes first? Who are you to tell us that our lives have been wasted and all that we fought for has turned into dust? He was one of those lonely old men who live in the past, telling stories you don't want to know about how it was then. The hunger and hardship, the hopes and the struggles of so long ago.